Welcome to Imagine This Podcast,
the show where we discuss, celebrate, and highlight all the excellent and abundant arts and culture in Milwaukee.
We hope that after listening to the pod, you'll see and experience our city and the incredibly vibrant arts and culture community in a new way.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have an asset. We have a non-fungible digital asset. It is accomplished.
What I appreciate about you and this place, it's not about being talk. We talked about this, I believe, the last podcast, right?
At least
you've taken action. At least, that's right. At least the last one. So talk about it. Tell us about it.
So what we mentioned last week, we'd reach out to David Najib Kassir about his fidget sculpture, Epstein Was Murdered, and ask him whether or not we could turn the last remaining photo of it into a non-fungible token. Attach a non-fungible token to it and put it on a marketplace. For those of you, we'll link to it in the show notes. You can go to Rarible, you can bid on it. Given that the sculpture does not exist anymore, we tried to keep it in the office, but in the move, it sort of got destroyed. And so now the only remaining record of this is this photo with the artist signature, artist statement, and the price that he had priced it at on March 11th, 2020, day the NBA shut down at one of our artist support, our last in-person meeting, $35,000. So when we put this NFT on the marketplace, we set it at $35,000 or 20 Ethereum. Ladies and gentlemen, in just one day, it has gone up to be worth $40,000 priced at 20 Ethereum.
I mean, okay, a couple of things. I want to clarify for anyone that has not looked at the photo linked in the show notes. When we say sculpture, it's made out of these like fidget toys that we would bring to in-person meetings before, right? So it's a couple stress balls. It's like pipe cleaners.
Right.
This is what we're talking about.
Right.
And I have some questions. Like, is it really worth that?
I don't think you have questions. You have point of views that are disguised as questions. But go ahead. Go ahead with your points of views disguised as questions.
That pretty much summarizes my entire ethos, Mac. That's true.
Right.
Well, David priced it at $35,000.
I trust the artist at pricing it.
Back then, right?
Okay. Yeah.
And this is a one of one. So there's no, I mean, we can prove it that the one that's on Rarible is the one of one that that we own, that, you know, is set at 20 Ether right now.
So what happens if someone bids on it and wins it at less
than? I think we have to say that they win it. I think we have to say, the 20 Ether price is the buy it now price, right? Mm-hmm. The eBay buy it now price. People can still bid on it. So you can go, if you have a Coinbase wallet or a Rainbow Digital Bitcoin wallet, you can go bid on it however much Ether you think this thing is worth. And we will sell this within some period and of course split the profits with or just cover our costs. Oh, because I think here's the thing, right? Here's the takeaway from this is that it actually costs 0.005 Ether to make this thing. Mm-hmm. So there's cost to go in to making NFTs, and it's not cheap. It's about $100 to actually get this token mined through the blockchain. So it's not like, so for those of you who've been listening to all of this over the last few weeks and maybe hearing about this on NPR, and you're like, I'm going to make NFT digital art and get it sold. I mean, there's still some startup costs. You still, for every token, you're still spending somewhere on the order of at least $100. I mean, this was a 5 megabyte photograph. It cost $100 in fees and other sort of mining to get that blockchain.
To make the non-fungible
to verify token. Right. So if it were a larger piece, right? If it were a file that was bigger than 5 megabytes, potentially there would be more.
Oh wow!
Investment cost in actually getting the digital token. So it's not like you're just putting stuff on eBay and just like raking in $600,000, right? I mean, you have to actually, there's actually investment costs to go in because it requires some computing power to create the to get you in the book, in the ledger, as it were, the blockchain ledger.
So
go to Rarible, go bid on it.
Yeah. it's a pretty cool piece of work, and want to make sure our artists can live off that work. So congrats.
And I think that's also part of our mission too, right? Is to sort of understand what's new and help people understand like the opportunities that are out, that are potential out there, and also the different kinds of potential pitfalls, such as when I did not buy enough ether to be able to get our NFT made the first time. I had to buy another $100 worth of ether.
Yeah, I mean, and listener, if you, like me, have been completely avoiding NFT articles because it's just too much for your little pandemic brain to process, we're here to help. I mean, not me, but David and Mac are here to help.
I think it's mainly David, and I'm just sort of saying, yeah. That's me. That's my role. Yeah.
That's basically been our internal staff chat has been like me like sending screenshots of like all of the different hoops I've had to jump through to get into cryptocurrency over the last week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I go, okay.
You're like, as long as that's not my $100, right? That's been your point of view. And I'm like, I'm just here for the story. I just want to tell people about what I've learned and that's what right. I've experienced. And then if we're lucky, y'all, this is gonna be like Giphy Cat and makes a ton of money, and we're gonna be hysterically laughing at this whole thing.
David Najib Kassir will be hysterically laughing.
That's well, right. Of course, he's getting the lion's share of this, but
yeah.
You know, I'm just sort of saying like, or whatever, we'll kick more money to the artist relief fund or whatever. Whatever it takes. Cause again, my take is there's some sort of mad money in the dark webs that's getting laundered through armaments and stuff. And I might as well have that go towards, you know, artists and people as opposed to other cartels.
You basically convert things into ether and then that has value. It's crazy.
Yes. Again, I'm playing my role. Yes. Yes, it is. And so let's get in on that. Let's surf that wave. The other thing we just want to share, and we're not going to dig too deep on it. What sort of made you think, that's another segment. What made us think, we're not going to deep dive in it, but, I was really compelled by the defector.com article, which was a review of the, documentary on Netflix called, I believe, Made You Look, which looks at the sale of a Rothko, which turned out to be false, but examines questions about, well, what is worth something? What makes something worth something? And ultimately a reflection on the art world as well as commercial art sales. And I think it's a super compelling piece. It's not just a movie review, but it asks a lot of questions that we're asking here on saying, does something that's inherent, what is the inherent value of art? And what happens when certain markets declare some things are more worth than others. And I think it's a fascinating read. So I encourage you, listener, to check it out. And so that's what made me think this week.
And you also made the whole staff think by sharing that in our Monday staff meeting, right?
Yeah. I do the unfortunate thing of making the staff think of things as well. Why should I be alone? Why should I be alone and think?
Well, I think that this also relates to our first conversation about NFTs too, right? Like Lindsay's thought about like, well, what is that thing worth? The Epstein was murdered. Our NFT, what is that actually worth? I mean, Rarible says it's worth 20 Ether or $40,000. And then similarly, I think, you know, reading that Defector article, I think my takeaway from it was, you know, while sure it wasn't an original Rothko, it's still beautiful given that it's a 100% accurate you know, reproduction, forgery, as it were. What's that worth, right? Like who's buying that to put on their wall? And I think that sort of, it continues to bring up really interesting questions about, you know, authenticity, value, and the value we place on things that, you know, by and large are about genius, right? Like we pay for a Rothko because there's only one of him who does that thing of color blocking really, really well. And everybody knows it and everybody wants it. But you know, to the point of the David Bowie video from a couple weeks ago, there are plenty of people who do the same thing. Why is it that, you know, it's the Rothko that's worth millions and millions and millions of dollars? What do you think, Lindsay?
You know what? I was trying to pull up the article to remind myself, and I think I ran out of free defect reviews. Trying to get me to log in.
Get Lindsay CNN, get Lindsay an email address so she can get defect reviews.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot going on, Lindsay. We got to get for you.
Yeah, no, you know, something the article, when you all check it out, you'll see this. Something the article further down speaks about is the influence of the lack of critical
review
coverage, right, review of the arts and how that does affect our perceived value of it. Mm-hmm. And so something I'm curious for our work group, our community to think through is if we are moving from a model where we can expect our major publications to have art reviewers on staff, what's next? What's next that helps ascribe value without limiting what artists can achieve that level of recognition? So that's been on my mind.
As well as sense making for the rest of us, right? Because it's putting in context, how do we know something collectively is. So yeah, that was an interesting part too, right? The role of criticism, the role of setting context for these pieces. So yeah, so listener, if you're curious like us and you've still got some defector free views left, I think it's worth the $8 a month. But again, I'm not shilling for them. I'm just saying as a guy. I think
they're not a sponsor of our.
No, I think it's a lovely independent journalism product. And that's our democracy in 2021, where I have to pay for independent journalism products.
Big promoters of IJPs around.
IJPs
and NFTs.
Can we rename our podcast to that? IJPs and NFTs.
I think our goal is to hit every consonant and vowel. Like, we're going to cover it all. So everyone at home, there's a scorebook at home and they're crossing out NFT and IJP.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Well, here's a few more letters. MSO. So I wanted to share.
Oh,
there we go.
I like it.
Like that transition. Okay.
That's good.
This morning I had the opportunity to go to a rehearsal at the Milwaukee Symphony's new hall.
Just a little bit.
Part of a video project that we're working on.
Hint,
I won't tell you anything else. The staff at the MSO were gracious enough to welcome us in for a little bit. And that was my first time in the finished hall. And it was exciting to have a destination to go to at a specific time on a weekday morning. it was more exciting to sit in the hall and hear live music and be brought back to the sense memory of honestly, one of my favorite places to be is the back of a concert hall.
Mm.
You know, in my previous work, I loved to be there and taking in the audience. You know, my work was in marketing for performing arts. And so seeing the audience that made it to that show, seeing how they engaged with the work. And, you know, when something on stage is really, really good and compelling, the way people's body language and the way that they're absorbing it and experiencing the space with their fellow audience members around them is really fascinating and compelling. And so sitting there, not really surrounded by an audience, but surrounded by the chairs that will eventually be filled with audience, it made me really excited for a post-COVID future.
Mm.
So that got me thinking, I wonder if either of you have a story you could share about being in a place, experiencing an arts and culture moment that felt like you felt most at home as yourself. Because that's what it feels like being in the back of a concert hall for me.
Hmm.
You know, for me, as many of you know, I used to be an actor, sometimes writer, and a stage and film director. That's at least what I wanted to do early on in my career, and spent a good amount of time in Los Angeles, New York, trying to do that. And then after sort of finding my way into the nonprofit leadership world, so really got away from it for many years. And it wasn't until, I think it was 2012 or 2011, after having moved to Milwaukee, it might have been 2013, it was a couple of years ago, where I found myself on stage again in a production of Cowboy vs. Samurai directed by Mark Bucher over at the Boulevard Theater before it had gone fully decentralized. When that theater was still on KK in Bayview. And, you know, to your point, Lindsay, like every night when we were performing, I would just sort of stand on the stage and sort of go through my warm-up, just getting ready to do the performance. And every night I sort of felt like I was at home. And there was something about like the sound of an empty theater, the smell of an empty theater, and the kind of like stillness that I really enjoy and really find, I think some might find it isolating, but I actually find it like just really, really calming. And I sort of felt the same thing actually visiting the Cabot Theater and having a nice tour from Jack Lemmon a couple last year. Just sort of standing on that stage with him talking about, you know, all the work that they do, just sort of feeling like, oh, this is where I belong, or this is the place that's home to me.
Mm. You know, it's funny. You sort of said that sense memory. It's been a while for me. You both talk about the stage. Sometimes I'll go to like the Sherwood Library because I live in Sherwood, and they have meeting rooms in the basement that folks meet, like the community meets. And sometimes I've done some community like organizing around like voter registration and stuff. So I'm with other residents and we rent out the space to do it. But so sometimes when I enter spaces like that and it's just like a blank room, right? With not folding chairs. Sometimes it's folding chairs, or sometimes this room has like the really like, if it's a really nice room, it's got like the futuristic office furniture that's super plasticky, but it bends and whatnot. But it's usually like a 12 by 12 room that's blank. And it reminds you of like rehearsals for improv. When I used to do improv in Chicago and taught in some in Minnesota and in Houston. And it's not the stage. Like we're not practicing on the stage. We're practicing. Maybe it's the Park District side room. Maybe it's somebody's able to finagle a conference room at their paid gig during the day, but there's something about a blank room and you set up the chairs a certain way and then people start coming in. And for about 2 hours, you're going to do, improv rehearsal. You're going to work on some, you know, we're going to do some scenes. We're going to do some, you know, exercises and whatnot. And there's something about a blank room and a blank, you know, some, even like the feeling of setting up chairs it gets me excited of the possibility and the risk that people are about to take and they're going to experiment. And I miss that a lot. And I'm really partial to spaces. I think the last time, Lindsay, I might've said that I think you had an underground collaborative meeting for the marketing group that was in the basement of the underground collaborative. And it was like in this room that was really kind of darkish and like, you know, didn't have any windows. And I think you had a look of like, oh, I guess we're having a meeting here. I'm like, this is rehearsal. This is where you do rehearsal, this kind of space, you know?
There are mirrors on the wall. Yeah, we're going to look at ourselves and learn some hard truths.
Yeah. Right. So yeah, that's the last sort of powerful sense memory of feeling at home is a room that could be where the ensemble practices for that week. So yeah. So thanks for making us think about sense memory.
Yeah. You know, speaking of memory of arts experiences, Mac, something that you and I got to take in together pre-pandemic was an exhibit at Latino Arts by the artist who we're going to have on today. It was a Tuesday or Thursday morning, like 8 a.m. It was a coffee and churro hour.
Yeah.
Where we got to drink coffee and hear directly from the artist of the exhibit, which was Brianna Hernandez Baurichter. Mac, what do you remember from that? We're gonna get into it in the interview, but what do you remember of that exhibit?
I just remember you extended the invite of, hey, I'm gonna go check this thing out. And I was in the mode of like, let's say yes to everything. Yes, let's go. And I was really glad I did, because one, I got to check out the awesome space that Latino Arts has, and really got to the privilege of connecting with an artist directly when I'm looking at their work at the same time is such a great, it's so great and super compelling. And so we're really excited, to have Brianna Hernandez Baurichter, who's a Chicana artist, curator, and educator, who's guided by socially engaged practices, guided by her experience working in community organizations, gallery, museum, and higher education settings, as well as a consultant with public health researchers. I'll really talk about Brianna, about her journey, but also her current work as the director of cultural transformation at the Milwaukee Artist Resource Network, where she's developing policy and community engagement initiatives to address equity and inclusion in the greater Milwaukee area arts community. After the break, we get to meet Brianna.
Brianna, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, really excited to dive into learning more about your work as an artist and as an administrator and your new role with Marne. But to get us into the conversation today, we'd love to invite you to share an arts and culture experience in your past that really left a strong imprint on you.
You know, I've been thinking about this question because there's so many things, you know, I mean, as an artist, I'm always seeking out new arts experiences to be inspired by and learn from. But something that's really shaped, I think, the way that I formulate my process as an artist and how it relates to me as the, as an individual person as well, is reading the work of Guillermo Gomez Pena. He has this really great book called The New World Border. And as you know, a performance artist and a writer and an activist, he kind of combines all these things of his experience as an immigrant and having a mixed race child, and all of that combines to how we think about what is somebody's place in a culture and how do we move between those things if there's a combination of cultures within our identity. So that's always really stuck with me, the way that he frames it, the way that he talks about hybridity and how that integrates into his performance pieces as well. So, you know, because I do video art and performative elements, I'm always looking at, you know, what did he do there that should really solve that problem? So it's had a long lasting impact on some of my work.
I'm curious, do you remember how you first heard of Pena, or did someone important introduce you to his work, or just in your own research come across?
Well, I remember first learning about some of his performance work early on in, like, you know, standard art history 101 classes. But then I had a mentor specifically refer me to his writing in terms of when I was trying to flesh out how I was integrating my experience of my own identity within my artwork. She was like, you know, maybe this will help you kind of figure out, you know, how you're framing this. And so I just started diving in and kind of became obsessed almost of like, oh, everything you're saying is so perfect. So I just started diving in and reading more and more.
Wow. You know, Brianna, when I was hearing your story, it's just hard for me not to separate with what we're all collectively going through right now. Which is not just the unfortunate, you know, the murders on Monday night, but also our collective moment as a society. It's hard for me not to think about, we're all collectively trying to figure out how this all fits together, right? There's sort of mental models of what's your place and how it is. And you, from your own experience growing up as a hybrid, right? We say, oh, America's this great melting pot. But wait, there's something about melting that assumes melting away and invisibility, right? But when you speak of hybrid, I think you're speaking to still claiming and holding and honoring and forming new connections, forming new realities, at least that your bio said. So that's the homework I did. And I would love to hear transition to tell us about the projects that exemplify that spirit for you as an artist, or even as a, you know, whatever field you stay. Could you talk about some of the projects that exemplify that spirit?
Absolutely. And, you know, thank you for framing it that way. That's absolutely what I try to do with all of it, is not dissolving it or erasing it, but really proclaiming it. Because I think even though we talk about having a culture that is so mixed, whenever we run into individuals who have a mixed identity, whether that's racially or being immigrants or any other combination, there's often like a stigma around it because it's not this purity. And so we say that that's something we embrace, but then in practicality, it's normally not what happens. It's like you have to choose a side, or you have to pretend that this part doesn't exist, you know, or any variation of that. So in the work that I do as a person and as an artist, I'm always trying to put that front and center, because I don't want it to be erased. And I also want to be really honest about where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. You know, how does that lived experience inform everything that I'm making and the intention behind it? So it may not be apparent in every single work that I do, but it's integrated fully into my process. So when I'm making something, it informs the way that I'm problem solving of how does this physical piece come together with this physical piece? Or how am I translating this when I write about the work or speak about the work to help someone have an entry point? Maybe it's something that's a bit foreign to them, but because I'm looking at it from all these different angles, you know, having forced to negotiate those different angles within my own identity, I can probably find a space for someone else to step into this if it's completely new to them. So it's kind of throughout, but definitely in some more obvious ways, you know, I'll incorporate Spanglish into stuff, which, you know, it's pretty common nowadays, which I think is amazing because it's like something I grew up hearing. And I'm like, yeah, why isn't this more normal? Just make new words and start half your sentences in Spanish, half of it's in English, or maybe it's just a couple of words, but how can that be integrated? And how can the visualizations of ritual and movement be combined from different cultures into one piece that I'm making to more holistically speak to the concepts that I'm working with?
And I'm curious, go ahead, Lynn, sorry.
It's all good. I'm curious, in thinking about some past opportunities where audiences got to interact with your work. You're talking about kind of those entry points of people figuring out how they fit into what you're doing, or perhaps learn something about themselves by engaging with your work. I'm curious if you have a memory of, you know, an audience member engaging with your work in a way that either made you feel really seen or helped them feel seen in a new way.
Oh, wow. That's a good question. I feel like I'm very grateful to say that that happens a lot with different types of work that I do. So I have this series of large scale charcoal drawings that they take over like an entire room basically. And they're very obviously meant to be hybrid imagery in the sense that they combine things that don't exist with things that do and different textures and shapes of you know, a memory here or a texture of an actual physical object in the world here. And when they come together, I often get to see people interacting with them in a way where two people will be looking at the same piece and be like, oh, you know what I see here? I see, you know, a tree or something. And somebody else is like, oh, really? Because like, I see this. And then they start talking about it and they start talking about why they're seeing what they're seeing. And that's the entire intention behind the piece. So it's really exciting for me to see as an artist with those more open-ended pieces. But it, even with the pieces that are more personal, when I frame them in the physical space where someone can really move into it, either by, you know, changing their posture or being immersed, looking up at it or looking down at it or what have you, they start to kind of look at the work in a different way than I've seen with other pieces I've had in the past that are much more straightforward in their presentation. And so making those physical entry points allows them to think about the work in a new way. And then they'll come back to me and say, you know, at first I wasn't sure, but then I kind of changed the physically way that I was sitting and looking at it. And it made me think about this experience of my own. And it could be totally different from mine, but now they have this attachment to it and this connection to a deeper sense of themselves. So I'm grateful to say that that happens a lot, actually.
You know, you're bringing to memory for me when I believe Lindsay and I got to first encounter your work at Latino Arts 10 years ago. No, it was actually 16 months ago. Pandemic time. But I, as you were telling the story, I was actually going, I wasn't listening, but I was revisiting the moment where I was witnessing that large charcoal drawing that you had on the wall. It was about what, like almost like 15 yards by 10 feet tall. It just what it seemed like with that memory. And I remember feeling the sense memory of like, I want to go in, but it's also kind of scary. And then at the same time, you're like, oh, this is about death. Like, or like, you didn't say it, but like, I'm like, oh, that's it. That's right. That's right. Like, I'm super curious about that beyond world, but I don't want to get stuck there. Like, I was just going this whole thing. And I, to your point, I was engaging it, right? Just like you said, like, and which actually met me at my level. Because certain people have different dialogues with death or different dialogues with mortality, but it was able to meet me where I'm at. And I think that's what's really fascinating of how the work that you produced in that space, along with there was, I still remember one where you had to walk through a scrim, like you actually had to enter a booth almost, and literally an entry point. And and for me, it like denotated, if you, I made up that word, I'm in now the artist's eyes in a way. And that's what an opportunity, where sometimes when I'm like at a museum and I'm like walking up to a visual piece, I almost don't know where to stand. And that's okay on some level, but I think to your point, I do appreciate sort of, hey, look, see this for a second, just take a second. I know you're going to have your own lenses, but just for one split second. And we're, it's an audio pod, but we're all adjusting our bodies.
I know.
To simulate what we did. I know Lindsay also, I don't know if you had a reaction, Lindsay, that you, that still resonates with you from that experience or putting you on the spot. I'm putting you on the spot. Lindsay, what did you like about it?
Well, you said some of the things I was already going to say. I was, okay. It's cool to hear you reflect on, how just changing your like relationship to space changes your perception with of the art that you're taking in. Cause I remember what Mac talked about so clearly as well, the literally having to like walk through like a scrim hanging
sheets. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Whatever. What was it? Sorry.
Yeah. It is theater scrim.
Yeah. And it just felt, it felt also whimsical in a way, which is an odd word to use for an exhibit that like asks us to confront mortality. But it felt like it was a different way to engage with the work. And I really appreciated that.
Oh, I mean, honestly, that just means so much to hear from both of you, because that's the exact intention behind the work itself. And also the way it's presented, the experiences that you're sharing of what you felt about it without me kind of like coercing you to feel that way. You just like, that was your gut reaction. And it's exactly what I was hoping it would be, because I do know that while I understand why it's important to have more open, honest dialogue about death and the process of dying and the psychology of what that does with our other relationships with those who are still alive, I know that it's hard for people to start talking about. It's a very taboo thing in our culture, partially because it's just scary. And so I am always looking for ways to make it more accessible. Like, yeah, eventually you're going to get to the really hard part of the conversation if you're like planning your end of life care plan with your family. But maybe you start off getting there by entering the artwork and being like a little hesitant, but still curious enough because it's presented in a way that is inviting. And like you said, whimsical, like it can be whimsical. There's something very surreal about providing end of life care, because you're in this in between space, which for me is very relevant to like my mixed identity. You're kind of in between life and death, and in between the present and the future, because you're in this anticipatory space, which is part of the title of the work, it's coming and you're just expecting it and waiting and dealing with the moment as you can, but knowing that as soon as the moment is over, you're in an entirely different world. And so there is something surreal and whimsical about it, even if it can be dark. There's still moments of light that balance it out, because you're forming a different kind of relationship with the people who are in that situation with you. So I try to bring that into the work as well. When I try to find ways to make it inviting, it's what were those moments where I felt like that kind of like magical element to it,
And again, I just have to speak for me, what resonated in those from time, because anticipating something in the future, but yet the importance to be in the present and the now, that's what also was this almost conundrum. Like, you almost want to be prepared for something that's even farther away from this current moment with the person, right, that you might be caring for, that you want to be witnessing and being with now. Whew. Yeah. So yeah, I'm working through some stuff on this call. So Lisa, I'll kick it back to you before I got to call my therapist offline here. But
I did want to, I think that this feeds into what you were just talking about as well. Part of your bio talks about that your work of embodying the spirit of a hybrid pushes you into a space of building new realities and making connections between worlds, between ideas. And so I'm curious, in the process of that building new reality, what's something you've had to let go of, and what are some truths that were challenging to accept, maybe?
I mean, I think that's an ongoing process, honestly. Again, going back to this point of what we idealize as a hybrid culture versus the reality of it for individual people, is that, there's a common stereotype of like, oh, you have to check a box, and which box do you fit into, let's say on the census or something. And there's not always a clear way to define that. Or it's like, you just have to check other, and then how do you phrase it in a way that makes sense? And so that's more of like this external to the work example of like what goes into the thought process is how am I being really honest about what that reality is, instead of it cleanly fitting into one box or another. That automatically makes it challenging, because it can be uncomfortable for people, even if you're not talking about death. When there's not a clear answer, that ambiguity can cause some anxiety, you know? And sometimes it's fun. Sometimes people really engage with it, but sometimes people are like, well, why though? Like, I want the answer. And I'm like, well, there's not always a clear answer. Yeah. It can be tough, but it's so coming to terms with that, with the fact that while I fully embrace, you know, the culture and the heritage from the woman who raised me, which is my mother, I also have to acknowledge the heritage that I have from my father and how that has bled into my lived experience, you know? So when it comes to the work, it's letting that shine through in a way that can create some uncomfortable ambiguities.
Well, you're speaking about the work and this particular piece we were speaking, exhibition we were speaking to last year was around death, right? And care, elder care, sort of that world. And so there's an alignment around public health, and that's my thread to talk about Imagine a little bit, where, you know, we're very interested this year, and given the urgency of the health of our city, in light not just of the pandemic, but also as a result of racism, right? Which mm-hmm. has also caused disparity in outcomes for our Black, Brown residents here in Milwaukee County and city. You know, we've been very thinking about how do we imagine leverage our city's arts and culture sector to be more aligned with helping hit those goals, those public health goals. So that's been front of mind. And that's something that's been front of mind for you in your own practice, right? And so really, really want to learn more about how's that resonated in your own artistic practice, or even your leadership practice, and how you are either an activist or how you in the systems you've worked in.
Yeah, I mean, oh my gosh, in so many aspects, it's kind of embedded into everything now. I mean, so I was in the experience of providing end of life care for someone with cancer. So it's a very specific, way of navigating care in terms of, there are definitely logistic overlaps with like elder care or other situations. But I always try to be very clear about that was my experience of caregiving, because there's also caregivers who provide lifelong care to someone. And the psychology of that is very different. So I don't try to claim that I understand what that is. But it really gave me this intimate insight into the systems that go into it for family caregivers, the support that's there or not there, especially depending on your background, like what is your racial and ethnic background? How does that relate to your socioeconomic background and the opportunities that you have to get support? And for us, it was not great. And so when I make the work, I'm always thinking about, how is this providing an immediate resource? So with the caregiver tools that I work with in terms of elevating them to this sacred status through gilding with gold and silver leaf and presenting them as altars, is like, okay, what is a mental resilience tool that caregivers can have in the moment when they don't have support and there's not a clear path towards getting that support? Which is to reframe how the tools that we use as caregivers are presented to us and how that reflects back on ourselves. So you might be in a stressful moment and thinking to yourself, I don't want to deal with this cheap plastic disposable medical equipment. This is not comfortable. But what if you didn't have that? What if you didn't have that mouth swab? How much harder would it be for you to provide care? How is that tool something that is sacred and helping you to do a better job for your loved one and making, elevating you in the sense that you're providing something unimaginably valuable to that person in terms of the love and the care that you're giving them. So for me, that's one way that the work does it. Another way is, you know, for other grievers to have these outlets of expressing things that are often normally not expressed. So with the two of those elements, it's very much about how can I support mental health practices for folks who are interacting with my work and then point them to other resources so that they can start that end of life planning on their own with their families and have that entry point. So it's very much across the board with my artwork. How can I be a part of that conversation in a healing way? I don't want to just bring stuff up for people. I want to actually provide resources and solutions as to the best of my ability. So I'm always learning. And part of that is I recently signed up to learn how to become a death doula. I'm really excited about it because I feel in a lot of ways that I provided the philosophy of what death doulas talk about a lot. I actually feel like I provided that for my mother without knowing what I was doing. And so now I'm like, okay, if I can go through some formal training, I can take that experience further to other people, also integrate that further into artwork. I'm really excited about doing that in the near future. And the other thing is with my work as a consultant and the collaborations that I have with other artists and public health researchers is a lot of them are trying to find ways to integrate the arts into their projects so that the work can be more healing. So they know that we can do all these polls, we can collect all this data, but what is it actually doing for the people who are involved in the study? And why are these conventional methods not working? And how can the arts bring in a layer that actually does provide some change for people? So I'm very grateful for the projects that I've been a part of, which have often included facilitating workshops with using the arts as like a curriculum to help people with emotional trauma or skill building. So like we worked with incarcerated veterans for like a project that would use the arts to reduce recidivism and give folks a, like a place to start when they're rebuilding their lives after they, you know, get out of prison. So there's been a lot of projects like that. They kind of range in terms of topics, but all of them have really been looking at what is that interdisciplinary approach that can really make a change, because these old models are not working. They might be well established, but people are still hurting. People are still looking for other resources even after going through traditional programs of these. So it's been really humbling experience for me to bring my knowledge of the arts into those other spaces and to learn more about the topics and the issues that each community is facing for whatever respective project I'm working on.
And it sounds like, Brianna, even as you're describing, you're the one weaving back and forth almost, not to say it's a geography, but it sounds like you're the one navigating these two terrains. And one of my questions is wondering, do you see them, not that it's binary and they're two different fields, but I kind of hold a point of view that it feels like they're separated by a wall sometimes. And I'm wondering, does that resonate with you from your experience? Because my wish that there wasn't a wall.
I
don't know, but maybe I just want to make sure it's not my mental model, right? I'm wondering, as one who's done this, like it sounds like you've kind of, not to take heat, but you'd have to carry water, as it were, like, hey, yeah, this matters. Oh, wait, hey, this matters. And it's a different audience you're talking to, but like, am I making sense or am I just-
No, you are totally making sense, because I don't see them as being separate issues or topics, but the way that we've structured our society, they very much are. There is a wall. There is a sense of, okay, I'm going into a situation with someone who's never experienced the arts in a way that has like made an impact on their life, and they're leading this project and they want to start incorporating the arts, but they don't, maybe this is the first time they're diving into that. So I need to go in and make sure that I'm presenting the work that I'm bringing to the table in a way that is not only the work itself for the program, but is also helping them access it. So I do feel kind of like this weird navigation of it. My hope is that in the future there'll be less of that wall, because I think both of them need each other, and it's forced to be in different languages, but the goal is the same. And so
what's going to take to break the wall down? Tell me what do you got? What do you got? Break it down for me. What do you got?
You know, so I actually, this is kind of an answer to one of your other questions.
Okay.
So maybe there'll be some repeat here, but for me, it's like, how do we start off early breaking down this wall? Not like, okay, we've all gotten to the table at this specific point in our professional careers and now we're talking about it, but how do we start that earlier, like in early education? Instead of having this STEM model, why don't we focus more on STEAM? Like, people have been talking about it for several years, but it feels like the movement on it is very slow. So if we start at, you know, youth education through, you know, throughout all levels of it with STEAM, it becomes less of this navigating between worlds. It's more integrated, interdisciplinary by default, so that maybe somebody who's interested in medicine shows up to medical school already thinking about an interdisciplinary approach. And maybe somebody who's interested in more specifically in the arts shows up to art school already with this knowledge of, you know, inequities in other sectors and how their work can be a part of like conversation change. So for me, it's like, we need to just start earlier, you know, especially with kids, like they need to see the possibilities of integrating these different modes of thinking.
Yeah. You know, speaking of breaking down those walls, we've spent a lot of time talking about your experience of entering into these communities and helping interpret how these two worlds of arts and health or arts and insert education, you know, et cetera, how they can work together. What from those experiences and that knowledge, what of that are you bringing into your role as director of cultural transformation? What are some of the opportunities there so far in your work with Marne?
Man, I hate to sound like a broken record, but I just see it as all being interconnected, you know, that it's not like this separate thing over here, this separate thing over here. A lot of times people ask me like, oh, how do you like balance your own studio work with this consulting work, with this, your quote unquote day job or whatever. I'm like, because I see it as all being the same thing. And that when I'm working in the studio, something that I'm problem solving in the studio can help me problem solve something in the classroom or at Marne. And it's kind of just naturally interwoven for me. It's just how like I see and move through the world. And so when I think about my role at Marne and how am I building sustainable infrastructure that is centered on equity, is what are all the other moving parts that need to be addressed so that we can get real specific when we say, like when we say we're prioritizing something, when we say that we value something, where in the details of like a policy does it make sure that someone is protected if XYZ happens, you know, instead of this kind of broad, like, oh, that would be nice, is all these other projects have shown me how much of a domino effect there is between things that aren't always very obviously connected by a straight line. And so when I do my work at Marne is really keeping that in mind, like anything, any system we have, any program we have, any value that we state, there's gonna be an effect somewhere else, whether that's within our internal system or in a, you know, community outreach piece. And so how am I like doing all the checks and balances to make sure that that's accounted for? So it's gonna, you know, it's gonna be a process, but I feel like as a team, as we learn all these different elements of what needs to be integrated into these new systems, it'll just really in the long run be more sustainable and be more accountable.
I'm thinking about it like that, I don't know if domino is the right word, but like you press on one part of the system and it shows up in another part of the system.
Right.
You know, and sometimes it shows up in ways you didn't expect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm experiencing this in real life as I'm doing more running. It's like, oh, my back hurts. And then my Cairo guys, oh, it's your hips. I'm like, your hips. Yeah. And it shows you your hips are connected to your lower back. So you got to do some more hip stretches to loosen up the back. So like, could you tell me a quick story about one of those, like you're pressing on one part of the system and it shows up in another way in the other system that you're either surprised or curious about or wondering? Do you get what I'm saying? Like, because maybe there's things that are less obvious, but I would love to hear sort of how you're noticing as you're paying attention to one part of the system, but it's showing up in another way.
Right. Yeah. I mean, do you mean with my artwork or?
I was going to say, I'll speak to you like in the role of Marne, right? Like you're looking at the arts and cult, the artists and creatives in Milwaukee, at least the ones that are members of Marne, right? At least I know that's, but I'm sure you're thinking as a whole, right? And I'm sort of curious to see what you're noticing or seeing. And again, maybe I also recognize visual arts might be different from dance, might be different from performing arts, right? They all have our nuances. And so I know you're not casting a wide brush.
Right. Yeah, no, but it's a good question. And it's true. You know, like you push down one area and then something else happens over here. And you're like, what, like, where is that connection? How do we reconcile that? Because we want to make sure that we're really being comprehensive.
Yeah.
I think for me, just having been involved with these different projects with public health researchers is seeing that when we talk about arts equity, we're not just talking about the arts, you know, obviously people want to have a great show or a great performance and on all these things. And they want to maybe sell their work or book a gig or something. That's all like very important. And we need to be fleshing out how we're supporting that as an organization, but also how we're looking more broadly, like, if we want to talk about arts equity, we need to talk about equity in general across sectors.
Mm.
So, you know, when I was working at the medical college in their diversity inclusion office, is like, we look at the structural determinants of health, and it's not always just about, are you a smoker? You know, obvious, like that's a pretty obvious example.
Mm-hmm.
It's about all these other things that go into chronic and acute lived experiences that determine, are you going to end up in the hospital? Are you going to end up with, you know, a different condition that impacts your ability to go to work? All these other things. And so for me, looking at arts equity, it's the same thing. It's what are those structural determinants, and how are we doing our best to, you know, make access points and facilitate, you know, so that there's less barriers, and also understanding that our efforts need to be long-term, because if we are going to collaborate across sectors to make that happen, to make this arts equity vision happen, it's not just dependent on what we individually do, but how are all those other forces moving towards that goal as well in, you know, in their own respective areas.
Yeah. You know, hearing you talk, I'm thinking about how much great energy there is in Milwaukee around this idea that artists and creatives can contribute to those longer term equity goals, but also thinking about, why haven't we already achieved that? You know, we're so eager for that to happen. I'm curious, from your work with artists, if you have a perspective on, I want to say the really easy, like, glib answer would be money, right? Or resources. But I am curious if you have a perspective around, like, what are some of the steps that we haven't quite accomplished yet that would help us in that goal of getting towards the arts and culture community being essential in building greater equity for the city at large?
I mean, I think there's a lot of steps. You know, part of it is, I have two kind of main reactions to that. One is, there needs to be more collaboration. You know, there's a lot of folks doing great work across the city, but not all of us are talking to each other. So we're all independently, like, forcing boulders up a hill when it's like, what if we push the boulder together, you know? So I love that we're having these discussions, that, you know, the connections that you all have been making. I think that's really what's needed, is more collaboration, more group effort towards these goals. Not that it's not happening at all, just that we need more of it, you know? Mm-hmm. And another thing is, Wisconsin, I mean, most of us know this, I think, at this point, that Wisconsin's funding for the arts is so bad that anything we want to do is like, well, gosh, how do we pay for it? You know, that's always the question. Meanwhile, our neighbors, Minnesota, like, they're doing great. Like, well, what can we learn from you? I'm very grateful to share that I've just started this program with the National Association of Latino Arts and Cultures. It's an advocacy leadership institute.
Mm.
And so it's this kind of intensive fellowship program where folks from across the nation can learn more about, you know, advocating for the arts in their area. Mm. And one of the first things we're talking about is, like, who is actually showing up at these congressional members' doorsteps and saying, here's what we're trying to fund, here's why we really want you to, like, be involved, and how does this relate to your other goals? So noting that not just the arts sector, but other departments have their own budgets for the arts, how do we tap into that in meaningful ways? How do we have our representatives actually advocating for our state to receive funding in the first place, instead of just, like, letting it, you know, fly away because they weren't even thinking about it. So I'm really excited to learn more through this program about how can I personally, and as a part of an organization that is a resource to artists, be a bigger part of that advocacy for the state to just get more support in general through this basic funding. Mm.
Well, speaking of building influence and advocacy power, we like to offer our guests a few minute special privilege of pretending you are the city's czar of arts.
What do you mean pretending? You legit have the power. You legit have this. You legit have it.
Whatever you say is going to happen. It's real.
It's just 2 minutes, though. You just have it for it just lasts 2 minutes.
That's right.
It's legit. It's the real. I didn't choose it. It chose us, Lindsay. I didn't choose it. It chose us. Go ahead.
My apologies. No disrespect to the power that you're about to have for a couple minutes. What would you change? What's the first policy you would enact?
Or- Here's the thing, Brianna. Like you said, Brianna, you said earlier, you did hint at something. So feel free to riff. Mm-hmm. You know, you can add some more because I think you,
yeah.
It's very clear that you're talking about integrated arts education that does not exclude arts in the STEM push, right? So clear. So feel
yeah.
free to freewheel and riff on other areas that we need to get back.
No, thank you. That was the question that I was referencing earlier. Is I knew this question was coming and I was like, yeah, I really think that in terms of uplifting arts and culture, we need to have it more embedded from the start in the value system of our education. You know, we push STEM all the time, and it's not that STEM isn't great, but it's incomplete without the arts, and the arts are incomplete without a more holistic view of the world that it lives within. You know, we've very much as a culture separated the arts from everything else that we do. And so for me, it's like, well, you want other people to just naturally engage with it. Well, how can it just naturally be a bigger part of their life? And that's through just, again, the integration, making STEAM the focus for just education in terms of critical thinking and problem solving, but also how the arts can be more embedded into our everyday lives in a way that is meaningful and cherished, and not just, oh, you're some fancy person who has your work literally on a pedestal, you know? So yeah, kind of bridging that gap by starting with education, because that's where we learn most of what we know about the world. So that's what I would do. Champion STEAM.
Well, it was a glorious reign, Brianna, but Brianna, I think what we're going to do is do our best to the legacy of it. We're going to, at Imagine, we're going to carry it out. And I think what really resonates for me and Lindsay and all of us Imagine is you just named it. Art isn't this thing on a white pedestal with bright lights on. I had to pay a ticket behind velvet ropes to get to it, right? You're like, this is the air, this is the sun, this is the water we breathe. This mm-hmm. is what we went to when the pandemic hit to help us be human mm-hmm. and to cope. And to be in touch with what matters to ourselves, right? That's what you're saying. And we look forward to joining you, and not just as an independent artist, but also Marn, and making sure Milwaukee gets closer to that vision of it. So, and we're so grateful for your time on the pod as well as your leadership.
Well, I'm so grateful for the invitation to be here and to continue these discussions. You know, I'm really hopeful that together, yeah, we can make all these things a reality.
Our time together is done, but people can find you. Let's keep it going. Where can they find you? Plug away.
Okay, great. So my website is briannalhb.com. So briannalhb.com. And it's the same for my Instagram. It's just at briannalhb.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Brianna. Talk again soon.
Thank you.
Well, Mac, what a joy to talk to Brianna. She hit on all of our talking points, all of the Imagine talking points.
The perfect guest ever.
That's You're right.
Absolutely.
That's
correct.
Right. But really, really delighted, you know, over a year on from first learning about her and her work, to get an opportunity to hear more about what she's up to in Milwaukee, and look forward to future collaborations with her and Marn.
I'm really still resonating with the observation she has around how I think the city is a fierce set of independent makers. While that's really cool on some respects, I join her in the sense of what would it take for us to really, I even say for us, we should collaborate more, already sounds cliche, right? And I'm tired, but I do think there's something about, and the way she works, I think is going to invite more of that possibility. And so, mm-hmm. I'm really excited to see that unfold for herself, not just as an artist, but also in the role of supporting the Milwaukee Artists Resource Network in connecting their stakeholders and their practitioners together. So super excited about that.
Do you know who else I'm excited about?
Our unfolding listeners, unfolding masses and masses of listeners unfolding in front of us. Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and like to support the pod, please share it with others. Post about it on social and leave a rating and review, or contact us directly at pod@imaginemke.org.
I'm Imagine This podcast is a team effort produced, edited, and hosted by MacArthur and Teague Wood, David Lee, and Lindsay Sheridan, and is part of the Imagine MKE podcast network.
Make sure you also listen to and subscribe to Black Imagination, as well as listen to our back catalog of Arts Forward MKE, all of which can be found at imaginemke.org/podcasts.
To catch all the latest from Imagine MKE, hit us up on Twitter and Instagram at @Imagine_MKE or Facebook or LinkedIn at @ImagineSpaceMKE.
Thanks again. We'll catch you next Tuesday when we've got another awesome guest on board. Till then, bye.